Hello, hello, and welcome to Art House Garage, the snob-free film podcast where we make art house, indie, classic, and foreign cinema accessible to the masses. I'm your host, Andrew Swetman, and we are continuing to look at the best films of 2020 for this season of the podcast as we run up to the Oscars in a few weeks. And today we're adding a couple more foreign films to the lineup. One is a movie called Martin Eden. Stay tuned for that conversation with filmmaker Graham Gordy. And I'm also going to give my thoughts on the Oscar-nominated film another round. Don't go anywhere.
Afhandling. Daglig indtagelse af alkohol. Ja. Tilstræbt til konstant niveau på en halv promille.
Med henblik på indsamling af evidens.
Ja.
Psykologiske
og psykoretoriske følgevirkninger samt undersøgelse af forøget social og faglig ydeevne.
Det er kun i arbejdstiden, vi drikker, ikke?
Men det er jo ligesom Hemingway. Vi drikker ikke efter 8 og ikke i weekend.
Er I klar?
So the Oscars are coming up in just a few weeks on April 25th, and the nominations dropped last week. I won't go over all of them now, but if you're curious to hear my thoughts on them, I talked about them with friend of the show, Rance Collins. He's also an Oscar fanatic and expert. That was last week. We recorded that conversation on Instagram Live, and it's up now on IGTV. I will link to that in the show notes. For the most part, I'm pretty happy with the nominations. One of the biggest surprises this year came in the Best Director category. Not only is it the first time two women have been nominated in the same year, that's Chloe Zhao for Nomadland and Emerald Fennell for Promising Young Woman, but there was also a nod for Thomas Vinterberg. He's a Danish director and not really a household name in the US just yet, but he's nominated this year for his latest film, Another Round, which is also nominated for Best International Film. I caught up with this movie on Hulu recently. When I first heard about Another Round, it was described as a movie about drinking. And that's exactly what it is. That description might make you think about bro-y college movies like American Pie or Old School, but that's not at all what this is. Another Round tells the story of four middle-aged guys who are a bit bored with their lives, especially the lead character Martin, played by Mads Mikkelsen. He's struggling in his job as a high school teacher, and his marriage and family life are not going great either. At the beginning of the film, Martin meets up with three friends, and the four of them reconnect over drinks before concocting a plan. One of the four friends, Nikolaj, is the school's psychology teacher, and he's heard about a psychologist who believes humans are born with our blood alcohol level just slightly too low, and that to be our optimum selves, we should be at about 0.05%. It's kind of a harebrained scheme, but seeing as how this night of drinking has so thoroughly lifted each of their spirits, they decide to test out this blood alcohol theory by drinking just a little bit all the time. So the rest of the story follows what happens as they drink morning, afternoon, and evening, constantly monitoring themselves with breathalyzers to keep that 0.05%. So yes, this movie is about drinking and the effects it can have. It ends up covering a lot of different aspects of drinking and drinking culture. We see the characters in the film drinking socially, drinking to connect, drinking during a romantic situation. It looks at kind of all the different ways drinking can reduce anxiety, make you more social or personable or fun. But then it also shows the other side too. What's it like when you drink too much, when you make yourself sick drinking, or when you're drinking alone or drinking while grieving? And what about alcoholism? Does that play into this? It hits all these different aspects of drinking culture. All of the four central characters end up having some very positive and some very negative experiences around this experiment they're doing, and it affects their work, their marriages, their parenting relationships, and their friendships. The film is fascinating for all that stuff, but it's also amazing for its performances and its direction. There's really not a weak performance in the film, and Mads Mikkelsen is especially great as the lead, Martin. At the start of the film, it's no wonder that his students and his wife find him boring. He's so deadpan and subdued, it would almost be funny if it wasn't so depressing. And Mads Mikkelsen really makes that feel believable, that this really is this guy's life. That serves to really show a stark contrast, too, when he starts opening up socially. It makes you believe he would actually go for such an experiment because it immediately seems like it's making his life better. The direction by Vinterberg is also fantastic. It's shot in a very realistic style, lots of natural light, so it feels very grounded in reality. And it's a very funny movie. There are several moments that sort of blend a comedic and a dramatic tone at the same time. Or there's moments when you expect something to be played for laughs, but it isn't. For instance, Nikolaj is a parent, and he mentions early on that his kids often sleep in bed with he and his wife, and they also frequently wet the bed. So they kind of have a joke about that. Knowing that this film is about drinking, I immediately thought, okay, they're going to set up some big joke where he comes home and wets the bed himself because he's so drunk, and it'll be a big funny moment. Well, I was only half right. That does happen, but it's not a funny moment at all. It's actually really devastating, and it kind of shows what that might really be like for he and his family. Most impressive about the direction, I think, is the way the film, through a simple setup, is able to cover so much ground. The narrative never feels forced, and it's always very organic, and yet you get all these different aspects of the experience of drinking. Where the story ends up is really satisfying, and it has a great ending. Without spoiling anything, I'll say the final sequence of this movie is really remarkable. Definitely leaves you with a strong feeling. The plot is mostly done at that point, but it's like a nice nightcap to finish things off. That is Another Round, directed by Thomas Vinterberg and starring Mads Mikkelsen. It is streaming now on Hulu and VOD. For the discussion today, we're staying in the world of foreign film, moving away from Denmark, though, and instead turning to Italy. The film is Martin Eden, directed by Pietro Marcello and based on a story by Jack London. The film centers on the title character, Martin Eden, and follows his journey as he tries to break out of his working-class life and become a professional writer. Through what's basically a chance meeting with an upper-class family, Martin is introduced to the world of art, the world of language, and he decides he wants to pursue writing despite having no formal education. And it's a challenging road. As the film goes on, Martin interacts with a lot of different people. He becomes involved in political discourse. It goes to a lot of different places. And that's probably enough about it for now. I'll save the rest for the discussion with today's guest. And now it's time to welcome that guest. I'm so thrilled to have Graham Gordy on the show. If you've been connected to the film world in Arkansas very long, you probably know the name Graham Gordy. He's written for the HBO show True Detective, as well as the critically acclaimed Rectify, and he's the creator of a show called Quarry. He's also an actor. I actually became familiar with him first through the film Antiquities, which he co-wrote with director Daniel Campbell, and Graham plays a scene-stealing supporting role as the eccentric Jimmy Lee. Graham is also on the board of the Arkansas Cinema Society, so you can often find him hanging around ACS events. I'm so excited to have Graham on the podcast today. Welcome to the podcast, Graham Gordy. Thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me. I appreciate you asking me being on.
Yeah, I'm so excited to have you on the show. You know, there's someone that I, you know, became aware of a few years ago and thought he would be good to have my podcast. So I'm glad it's finally happening. But before we get into Martin Eden, which, you know, I was excited that you kind of selected that. I sent some options, and it's a movie that I've been wanting to watch for a while. So I'm glad to have watched it. Before we get into that, can you tell us about any projects you're working on? Anything upcoming? Has quarantine thrown your career off a little bit, or what's going on?
I mean, I guess it's thrown everybody's off to a degree. Yeah. I think for me, you know, probably 6 or 8 months before COVID hit, I decided to kind of take a year and write some things that, you know, I really cared about, and take a risk on those. And so I started writing a new series, like a new hour drama, you know, sort of comedic drama, but that I've written the first couple episodes of, and we'll try to take out to sell soon. And then adapted this novel called American War, which is a beautiful novel by a guy named Omar El-Akkad, set in starts in 2075 in the future, and is kind of a interesting sort of dystopian piece, but is so I adapted that, and wow. And then the other thing is adapting a book called Florida Man that Joel Edgerton is going to star in.
Oh,
and
wow.
So anyway, I gotta get to work on that. So yeah, a few things we'll see. You know,
kind
they're all speculative. We'll see, you know, if they actually get on the air. But that's just kind of the way that this works, I guess.
Well, those all sound fascinating. As those kind of take shape, I'll try to follow that and share stuff out on social media for people to keep up with. Because yeah, I'm excited to see all of those. Good deal.
Yeah.
Well, we have a couple more minutes too. Is there any other stuff besides Martin Eden that you've been watching that you want to just highlight? Any TV or movies or anything?
I'm trying to think. I mean, the other, in terms of sort of the, it's been such an odd year for movies. It's almost hard to find out like what you should be watching, right? And all of that.
Yeah.
I really loved Nomadland.
Oh, yeah.
I thought that Judas and the Black Messiah was yes. beautiful and wrenching and really well done. As far as series, like I really liked Normal People, the BBC series, I thought was just fantastic. And then we watched that show Wayne. That was actually, I guess, a YouTube original, but it moved to Amazon. And yeah, it's hysterical and fun and violent and anyway, it was a good time. So I think those are probably the most recent ones that I've really stayed with me.
Nice. I'm not aware of Wayne. That sounds really interesting.
What about you?
Yeah. I was gonna say too, Judas and the Black Messiah recently. I really thought it was great, especially Daniel Kaluuya's performance in that. I think it's just incredible. So I'm he won a Golden Globe last night, and I'm hoping he wins some more things for that, because I think it's definitely deserving.
Absolutely.
I watched Minari not too long ago, actually. That's coming up on the podcast. I recorded a podcast with that just yesterday, so that'll be in a couple of weeks here. Which I really thought it was great. And you know, of course, the Arkansas connection is always kind of exciting, and hoping that we'll win some stuff too. And then the prestige horror film kind of is the word that goes around with Saint Maud is a recent one.
I haven't seen that.
It's pretty frightening. I thought it was really good. You know, it's kind of it's A24, so there's almost like a cult around A24 these days, but it's kind of in that vein of, you know, thought-provoking horror, but it's got a lot of like religious themes too, which I thought was good. So I'll recommend that. And then I bought I got the Criterion Fellini set, and I watched just the first movie out of that, which is called Variety Lights. And so, which is interesting. He sort of halfway directed that with Rossellini. It sounds like I'm kind of learning the history around that as I go, but I thought that was good. And I have the whole rest of Fellini ahead of me that I've actually never seen before. So I'm kind of jumping into all of that.
Wow. Okay.
So that's an exciting project.
What a treat.
Yeah.
I envy you.
It was somehow I've gotten this far and never seen 8.5 or any of these others. So I'm excited to kind of watch them in order and kind of read as I go. But it'll be time consuming, of course, with family life and kids and everything else, squeezing in movies when I can. But yeah, that's what I've been doing here lately. So yeah, some pretty good stuff.
That's great. Okay. Well, good. I'll check out Saint Maud, and yeah, that sounds great.
All right. Well, without further ado, let's get into Martin Eden.
Et moi je m'appelle Elena.
Martin Eden. Plaisir.
Enchanté.
Ho deciso che voglio essere come voi. Parlare come voi, pensare come voi.
Oh sì, ma con qua facendo? L'assurda.
Ho riflettuto molto su me stesso e ho sentito come uno spirito creatore che mi divampava dentro, che mi incitava a fare di me uno degli orecchi attraverso cui il mondo sente, uno degli occhi attraverso cui il mondo vede. Insomma, voglio fare lo scrittore.
Qua la gente viene a lavorare. All right, let's talk about Martin Eden. So this is an Italian film that tells a story of a character named Martin Eden, and he dreams of being a writer. And it's got a lot of, you know, class struggle kind of things going on. And he falls in love early on in the film and with someone who's kind of upper class, and he's kind of working class. And so that's a big part of it. And he's writing and kind of self-taught. He doesn't have a formal education. And so that's a big part of the story as well. And he's sending off stories and getting rejected and rejected and rejected. And so it's about kind of the struggle there, and ends up being a lot about capitalism and class struggle and all kinds of different things kind of wrapped up in this story. And it's told in a way that's it kind of just follows his life over the years. And I found it pretty effective. I really liked it. It feels very kind of old school in a way, which we can maybe talk about why. I'm not sure exactly why I feel that way, but it kind of stands apart from a lot of the things I've seen recently. Yeah, so that's kind of the basic setup. A little background trivia that I found when I was kind of researching this a little bit. So it is based on a novel or a novella, I think a novel, by Jack London. Mm-hmm. Which was serialized back in 1908 or something, way back. And there's actually been, this is the fourth film adaptation of the story. I learned that. And I think the first one was in 1914, and a few of the reels have been lost. So it's kind of lost to history, which is interesting. But then there's been a few more. But I think the most recent was maybe in the 70s. So it's been a while. And this one, so Jack London wrote the story about an American writer. And so this has kind of been transplanted to Italy, and but there are some things to me that felt a little bit American about it. So we'll talk about that as well. But so a big thrust of this story is the way that he kind of wants to be a writer, and it's kind of about writing to some degree. And so I thought to have you on the podcast, Graham, was interesting to ask you, since I think of you primarily as a writer, and so does IMDb, but you've worn many hats on film sets, but you certainly have done a lot of writing. And so I thought I'd ask you, did this kind of resonate on any creative level as a writer, watching a writer?
Yeah. I mean, I think that for me, I liked the movie a lot, and I did, you know, I sort of purposely went in without knowing. I mean, a couple of friends had recommended it, and I was glad it was on your list, because this gave me a reason to watch it and try to watch it carefully. And when it came to, like, when I saw it was based on a novel by Jack London, my only exposure to Jack London was really reading, like, you know, The Call of the Wild and White Fang and To Build a Fire and all those sort of very, I feel like in, you know, junior high and high school, they would assign those because they seem like very sort of masculine stories. Yeah. And they thought that the boys might actually read them, you know. Yeah. And I remember liking them a lot. But I didn't have any idea much about, you know, Jack London's life or how insanely prolific he was for, like, you know, I ended up looking up a lot about him afterwards, just because you know, I guess this is a semi-autobiographical novel. And I mean, but the things that definitely resonated were honestly being feeling myself relating to the main character, insofar as, you know, not really having any formal education for writing for a very long time, feeling, you know, out of my depth for a very long time. Also, you know, just that experience of, you know, you start getting interested in reading books to impress a girl things like that, you know, or the, you know, and I think that's, I remember, you know, just feeling like at a certain point in my life, like, oh, there, sometimes you get introduced to these sort of beautiful things by people and you're interested in pursuing them because of people. And then at a certain point, the, you become more interested in the things that they introduced you to. Than the, you know, these sort of higher, more beautiful things. And so that sort of transition, I think, felt familiar in a way. I mean, I think that the way that, you know, one of the interesting things to me, and this wasn't my experience, but resonated in some ways with me, is that the Martin Eden character, you know, is sort of introduced to this world that he doesn't fit into, and he is interested in this woman who's part of this family and in this wealthy family, and they have all these things and they have all these sort of accoutrements, and then they have all these books. And so he decides that in order to, you know, feel worthy in some way of being in this home, that he will start sort of devouring everything that he can in term, and eventually I think that, you know, it seems like once he goes on those sort of trips and then he comes back, that once he's with this woman again, the Elena character, it feels like he's already kind of transcended that she's not that interested in in these things that he thought meant so much to her and this family, you know, and in a way, once the kind of, you know, the more sort of socialist aspects of this and all of this sort of starts coming out of him, I think it feels like he starts to realize, like, if these people actually understood what all these books are saying, they wouldn't actually live like this, you know, that there is this, they couldn't morally live like this. And then obviously, you know, he transitions into sort of a different character, different type of person himself once he does. And then, you know, the other thing I related to was just all the rejection letters, because it just, that does just feel, I mean, I still have, like, you know, a very bulky, you know, manila folder full of rejection letters for all the stage plays that I wrote and sent out when I was, you know, his age. Mm-hmm. So, and when I say, I just mean that, you know, early 20s seemed to be when Jack London was really, and this character was sending all this stuff out and getting rejected a lot. So, I mean, I thought that those things definitely resonated a lot.
Yeah. And I like all of that. So I've never been, you know, employed as a professional writer, but I was an English major in college. And so I've certainly done a lot of writing, for that, but yeah, I think I agree that it kind of taps into, like, for me, like, the spirit of creativity a little bit. It actually opens with him just talking into a tape recorder and kind of giving this monologue that's kind of about the power of words and kind of lofty in that way. And I was like, okay, all right, this is gonna kind of go there right at the beginning. And I liked that about it. And then just kind of, he has a line later on, I think he's writing a letter as he's kind of learning more and more about vocabulary. Even he says something about, when I write down these new words that I'm learning, I turn them into my friends and I hang out with them. That was kind tapped into my English major nerd a little bit with that kind of thing. So I really enjoyed that about it. But yeah, I think, what do you think about, like, the writing of the film itself? Do you think that the script itself was well written? There's a lot going on thematically with it, but yeah, how'd you feel about that?
I did. I mean, I thought that, you know, like I said, I'd never read the novel. I mean, my only exposure to the name Martin Eden was, I think it's a line in a Tom Waits song, honestly. And so I, like, went back and looked that up because he's to figure out if I was right. And he does reference it in one of his songs. But otherwise, like, I knew nothing about this. And like I said, like, I didn't really know a whole lot about Jack London's career because I read him so early on. And so, you know, I went into it kind of, I think I'd seen, like, you know, the sort of semi-autobiographical or something. So I was like, well, this is interesting. And also the fact that it was, you know, that Jack London was born in San Francisco and that this was a sort of American story and having a lot to do with the sea. And then, you know, and then just kind of making it during the early 20th century, and then it moving, you know, the writer and director moving it to Italy seemed very, very interesting. But yes, in terms of the screenplay, like I when it made the turn, mm-hmm. you know, once he started gaining some fame for that, and it made that kind of quick turn towards mm-hmm. him sort of turning into a bit of a monster.
Yeah.
And that took me by surprise, because I kind of thought that I was very endeared to the guy.
Yeah.
I'd become very endeared to him because of, I thought that, you know, we love the sort of Horatio Alger stories of the, yeah. the sort of self-made person.
Yeah, it's a pretty and jarring also, turn, but yeah, go ahead.
No. All I was going to say is just that it was so it took me a bit to sort of figure out, like, I was sort of looking at it through an autobiographical lens in a way. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, he's making such a strong move towards, you know, based on when he's like berating the guy at dinner, and mm-hmm. then when he does, you know, goes and talks to the class and things like that. And he sort of turned his back on a lot of what he'd been sort of saying before, which I thought was really, you know, really interesting. And so it took me a while to sort of reconcile that, because I still wanted to root for him so
right.
much,
mm-hmm.
but then he'd kind of moved into this other stage. And the only real hint that I had there was when he was reading, what's his name?
They talk about Spencer. Is it Spencer?
Yeah. Herbert Spencer. Okay. That's right. And, you know, and I saw that name and I was like, oh, he's, you know, I know very little about Herbert Spencer other sure. than the fact that he's sort of the survival of the fittest mm-hmm. guy,
you know,
that he's a guy who sort of took Darwinian, you know, theory and tried to apply it to society, which I think a lot of people, especially with my frame of mind, don't look back upon fondly. And in a way I was sort of like, oh, okay, good. Like he is mm-hmm. making this sort of turn towards individualism, and he is moving away from these sort of more social, you know, more socialist minded
yeah.
themes mm-hmm. of working with other people and the community that you live in, and you know, everyone having rights and all of these things, towards this more, you know, in some ways more of a cliche of what a famous writer might mm-hmm. become. So it kind of becomes a cautionary tale.
I agree with all of that. And I think, yeah, so I guess it's the last third, or maybe even just the last fourth or so of this, that it kind of takes that turn. And it is so jarring, because up to that point, we're kind of immersed, and it's kind of romantic in a way, as he's kind of pursuing this. And then it makes that turn and becomes so dark that, he you're right. He becomes kind of a monster. And even just I was going to mention the performances, but like the physical transformation that happens. It is so sudden too, that I watched, I haven't seen a lot of the films of, Claire Denis, but I watched 35 Shots of Rum recently. And it's just, I think her style, this is apparently something she does, and I'm just kind of learning, but that there's major plot points that kind of happen off screen, and you kind of have to figure out what's going on. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of how it felt, because it was like, oh, suddenly we're in this new, this kind of new dichotomy of how his life is, and it's not clear how many years have passed and all of that. But I do think that last section makes us probably a lot more narratively interesting than, you know, if it was just, okay, maybe he'll succeed and maybe he won't, but it's like, what is the cost of succeeding in the way he wanted, you know? So I like that about it, even though it makes for a much less have a happy ending. We can kind of maybe not spoil the very ending, but
right.
but it's I think I ultimately like that. At first I wasn't sure if I liked the way it made that turn, but I think ultimately it probably makes the film stronger. I think as far as the socialism and capitalism stuff, I think that's interesting. And I found it, I don't know if it's muddled on the film's part or if it's just my understanding is not there and I'm trying to catch up, but it's interesting because he's, you know, he's accused of being a socialist at certain points, and, you know, he's denied grocery credit because of it and that kind of thing, because they've published in the paper that he's a socialist. And then at other times he's denying it. And it, so it's complex in a way that, I had a little trouble following, honestly, but I did think was,
yeah.
Yeah. Did you have something to say about that?
No, I felt the same way, because when the guy, Matai or whatever,
like the older gentleman friend. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Which was, I was trying to figure out was that, if that was an allusion to the, Enrico Matai, the guy who was assassinated. They, that movie, The Matai Affair. But anyway, but it was just sort of, but yeah, he's speaking out against it. And so I was trying to put it together in the same way, because I did think that I was confused in that regard.
Yeah.
Like I was confused of like, okay, has he changed or like what has changed? And I think the point was that he had sort of changed and been like, well, this isn't working. Mm-hmm. Like this is not a viable. And I think part of it was a bit of a conceit to make it seem like, okay, he had moved to sort of pure individualism, that he had gone down the sort of, you know, the Spencerian road there, towards towards more personal advancement and things like that. So, but yeah, I agree with that, that was kind of that was confusing for me at first. And then when I looked at it in retrospect, I was sort of like, okay, I think I followed that.
Yeah.
I think part of that too, was that I spent a lot of the movie, and he very purposefully puts this in no particular time in Italy's history, you know, cause when it first started, I was sort of like, okay, is this taking place in the 30s? Mm-hmm. Is this before, you know, pre Mussolini? Like when they're doing all those, when he does all those sort of interstitials with the faces of the people, you know, in the area and all of that, they sort of, you know, I mean, they look like some of those Fellini faces, you know, but then I was sort of like, okay, well, wait a second. But then they're, you know, I see a car that looks like maybe a 80s model car. So it's like, is this in, you know, or is this in the 70s? And then they're constantly talking about, you know, the revolution. And I, at first I was sort of jarred by that. And then when I got to the end, I was sort of like, I actually like that it was, you know, that it was just a period of sort of, it had become a period of sort of dislocation and fragmentation by the time the movie, from the time the movie started to the time the movie was over, and that there was this sort of youthful optimism in him early on where he was inspired. And then when you sort of make that shift to later, it seems like he's become very disillusioned by all of this. And in some ways it felt like, you know, if they're that in a very basic way, that London's point is like, you need to feel part of something larger than yourself, you know, that you need to, whether it is a political movement or a social movement or religion or, you know, whatever that might be, it's like that this is not the way that you go in order to live a happy life, basically.
Yeah, no, that's good. I had kind of the same experience when I saw a car late in the film. I was like, wait a minute, when are we? And so I was like, maybe we're just sort of out of time a little or something. Like it's, and maybe this is a timeless kind of a struggle. It's kind of the point, which that, it did feel, you know, modern in a sense that being critical of capitalism and socialist ideas is something that seems like it's still, or maybe newly kind of renewing, becoming part of the national conversation. So that was interesting. There was a line I really liked that, you know, I wonder how much of this is in the original novel. I'm curious to read it, but this seemed like a line that could be, it seemed literary in a way, but somebody mentions contracts and he says, contracts, the only literature that capitalists admire. That was a really nice little quippy line. But yeah, so that aspect of the film I thought was really interesting. I liked all the kind of the working class, blue collar, white collar stuff as well. And I think it kind of it displays that well, or kind of shows that, you know, the show don't tell kind of an idea early on, where he's in the rich family's house. I guess I should give some background for listeners that haven't watched this, but he very early in the film sees a young man being kind of bullied and threatened by another man, and intervenes and saves him. And then this young man brings him home for lunch, and then he meets his sister, and he's turns out they're very wealthy, and that's kind of his way into wanting more than his kind of working class life. But it when he's first having lunch with them, he's kind of eating without manners and being very coarse in a way, and he clearly doesn't understand, or he's not familiar with any of the art that they have in their home. And there's a moment where she's playing the piano, and they're all kind of listening, and he's unfamiliar with the piece, and there's a pause, and he bursts into applause, and then it's clear that she was going to keep playing, she wasn't done yet. And it's just kind of a funny moment that I thought it was endearing in a way, but also illustrated that difference, I thought, in a clever way. But then just like working conditions and things, he's working these very hard manual labor kind of jobs. At one point, his friend says he's going to give up or quit, and this friend ends up quitting in kind of uproarious fashion, where but the night before he says, you know, it's better to live a tramp than a dead slave, or better to be a live tramp than a dead slave, is what he said. So yeah, it's kind of getting at the working class stuff really early on in the movie too. And I agree, like, I haven't read much Jack London other than, yeah, like White Fang, and I remember those things growing up. I would almost believe this was written by like Upton Sinclair or something. It had kind of that vibe of just being on the side of the working class and fighting in that way. I thought that was an interesting aspect of it. But then I like too that kind of that somewhat came to a head, and you alluded to this, you know, he has to go off and then comes back, and this object of his affection, Elena, has the attraction is starting to die a little bit, and that kind of comes to a head where they go to see a film, and then they get into an argument afterwards because she thought it was really great, and he disagrees. He said it was too sentimental or too too hopeful or something, and then that leads to her saying, "Well, the things you write are horribly bleak, and you'll never make it as an artist if you keep writing such sad things." And then he kind of basically calls her out on her privilege and brings her to the rough part of town, and she's deeply uncomfortable with that, which, you know, I'm not saying that was it's a kind of a cruel thing on his part to do, but it was a very interesting scene to kind of bring those things crashing together. And I like that it kind of went there with that theme. And again, that's kind of the beginning of the end for them, I think, which is interesting. But
I think that it was interesting to read about, because I knew that Jack London was basically the turn of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. And so sort of looking at it, even though it is sort of in some amorphous moment in Italy's history in the movie, it was like, okay, well, this is the time of when London wrote it, that he was still sort of in the midst of the Gilded Age, you know, pre-Depression, but also when all of the, you know, all the great sort of union movements, workers' rights movements were occurring in the United States. And it seems that, you know, as you're saying, in that Upton Sinclair way, that it is that he is addressing or attempting to address a lot of these things in his work. And, you know, and so I found that really interesting. And obviously that it seemed like he had lived a good portion of this. I don't know. I know that London died when he was 40, and the fact that he wrote, like, just looking at the bibliography of all he wrote, I felt embarrassed almost to read. You know, I was like, okay, well, yes, this is the Call of the Wild and White Fang and all of that. And, you know, he did go up to the Klondike and he did, you know, get scurvy on the way and lose his front teeth and all of these different things. But that he, I mean, I just can't, like, I was just agog at how prolific he was during the, basically the 20 years in which he wrote, and how little of his writing is about, like, sort of Arctic wilderness and how much of his writing is about all of these other things. I was like, okay, well, I just clearly know nothing about
that. I felt the same way. So, like, oh, it's the wolf guy, right? Who wrote this? Like, right. No, that's not really what he is.
But I mean, how many, you know, how many things that he wrote with a more, you know, union centric or more socialist message or things like that. And I think you're right. I mean, we are sort of repeating that in this, you know, we are in this sort of second Gilded Age when maybe that is part of the reason. And obviously there's, you know, I think our old stories are not really, our old sort of social narratives in terms of, you know, just capitalism working and, and things like that aren't really holding up in the way that they were. And so I think that it's and maybe that's part of the reason that that this filmmaker chose it to adapt and move it to Italy and all of that, just because it does have a new resonance now, I think.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And so I mentioned earlier that, you know, it kind of felt American in a way. And I guess what I meant by that was it almost feels like he's just kind of chasing the American dream, you know, even though this is obviously set in Italy. But yeah, I like that aspect of it too. Like he wants to be this self-made man. And I think that's part of what felt American to me too, is that, and yet he's getting, you know, these constant rejections and return to sender and all these things he's writing. But then there's like that thrill when he finally does get something published for the first time and gets that acceptance letter. But then too, I thought was interesting was, I guess this kind of goes back to more of the writer, the life of the writer kind of thing, is the pressure to change from, especially from Elena and her family. Like, if you actually want to be successful at this, you need to change your art. You have to be more accessible. And he just wants to stick to his guns and have that artistic integrity and kind of that struggle, I thought was an interesting aspect of this too.
And then, and yet when they sort of leap into the future and he has, you know, he's sort of blonde all of a sudden and has long hair and all of that. You know, I mean, he's living in a place that looks not unlike the place where she lived, you know, and yes, he's sort of giving away his money left and right, but it's not, you know, he's clearly not sort of stuck to his ideals in that way. And he seems very isolated. Like, even when the other woman, Margarita, I think is her name. Yeah, you know, that when she sort of comes back into his life, it's like they're all, because part of me was sort of like rooting for her, because you know, she sort of shows up a couple of times in the middle there, and I was like, okay, well, maybe, you know, that's that seems better for him. And then, but you know, they're still, like, when they jump to the future, they still seem sort of isolated from one another, and he's very much in his own head and his ideology, but he hasn't honestly sort of stuck to it in a way, right? Like the speeches that he would have given as a young man, you know, I don't think he would still be able to give those with a straight face when we get to that point.
Yeah, and he gives a speech at a university or something, and yeah, I guess that's kind of our way into, like, where is he now? And that's a really interesting scene. But yeah, I guess we've talked a lot about that kind of the script and the thematically things about this movie. What about just the style of it visually? Was there anything, did you like the cinematography and the kind of the visual style of it?
Well, I did, because I love those sort of early 70s heavily saturated, like long lens films. You know, it almost looked more like, you know, it looked almost like French Connection or something, mm-hmm. or, yeah. you know, the first half of Deer Hunter or something like that when you're first watching it. And so it just feels sort of, I kept trying to figure out, like, if there was a, you know, again, this was a time when I was trying to figure out if what time and place this was, what time and place this was set in, you know? And then, you know, the little kind of interstitial cuts of the you know, the faces and the places there, also, you know, the sort of boat motif that kind of plays throughout there. I thought that they, I mean, at times it was a little jarring because it seemed so sort of different visually from the other stuff that we were watching, but it definitely stood out, you know? So, but yeah, I just kept trying to figure out, and I see now that that's what he was trying to do in a way, but I was like, all right, those are really high waisted pants. And I know that Italian men really like high waisted pants, but like, is this the 30s or is these, you know, where exactly we were. So, yeah.
Yeah, it almost looks like archival footage that's kind of cut in there, and it's like it's color graded, you know, very bright blue or kind of a sepia tone at different moments. And yeah, it took me a while too to figure out like what's going on with that. Is this, at certain points it seemed like maybe this is Martin Eden's dreams or something, because sometimes we see it while he's laying in bed. But yeah, then there's this boat motif at one point when things are not going well. We see the boat sink, and so it definitely served to confuse the timeline, but I did think it was an interesting way to kind of, as it went on, I began to understand it as sort of his internal feeling, and maybe like a way to kind of poetically show how he's feeling. But yeah, a lot of it is just showing faces of the crowd as well, which is an interesting thing. And yeah, so it's an interesting choice that I guess I haven't fully figured out, but maybe that's a good thing, I don't know. But
I think, and it also seemed like when the camera was on him a lot in his early life, that there it was more frenetic, that there was a lot more sort of handheld. And then when we were like in Elena's home and things like that, it was more like locked off shots, you know, that were static or at least less, you know, much less frenetic with very little movement and stuff. So I thought that was, you know, and maybe that was attempting to sort of convey his emotional state, and not to say that necessarily improves for him throughout. I mean, he certainly seems happiest in the film when he's discovering other writing, you know, when he's reading those books and he's devouring them and he's learning and feeling sort of like he's been introduced to the, you know, the Holy Grail, or the key to what life is, that there are actual answers in there. Much more so than he does even when his own writing is published.
Yeah. He almost gets ahead of himself or something and becomes so jaded. And yeah, it's an interesting way that went. But I agree too about the, just the kind of early 70s look to it. Even just when I saw the trailer, I thought it felt old school in that way. This looks like it was shot on film. And so I'm still kind of learning to distinguish that different look, but then IMDb confirmed this was shot on 16mm. And, it feels of a different time too, just in the way it looks. But then there's some nice.
And as you work in through the, you know, your Fellini assignments, then, you know, you'll see that appear more. I mean, there were times when it felt like Armacord, or, you know, like that there was some so there was definitely that, which I, you know, I love the look of those films, so I almost wish they would make them all that way. Anyway, I jumped in right in the middle of your thoughts. I apologize.
I think the only other thing I was going to mention about the visuals of it is there's kind of a nice touch when he's receiving a letter, they're writing back and forth, Martin and Elena, when she's sending a letter to him. We see her just kind of on this blank, kind of colorful background, reading it out to him. And I thought it was a kind of a nice visual touch that I've seen a similar thing in a few movies, but it always is kind of jarring because she's like staring straight at us. And yeah, I thought that was kind of a cool little touch visually. What about the performances in this? Did any stand out to you in particular?
I think the actor who plays Martin Eden was you know certainly the one who sort of stood out the most, I think, just because you know I thought he did a very effective job between being a kind of you know unfocused sort of working class mm-hmm. person looking for something, you know, some meaning in his life, to becoming, you know, genuinely sort of inspired in this world of you know ideas and books mm-hmm. and things like that. And then you know then obviously once the transformation happens in the end, I thought he did that really really mm-hmm. beautifully. You know, yeah. So he certainly stood out the most to me. I mean, there were plenty of good, you know, performances in there, but that was he definitely steals it. So what about for you?
Yes, same. And he's the title character, so I guess that makes sense. But yeah, and I looked up his name. Luca Marinelli is his name, and he's in a lot of other things. I haven't actually seen anything else he's in, but even some more kind of. He's in some like a Netflix action movie, The Old Guard, which I just heard the title of and haven't seen. But yeah, so interesting range there. But I would love to see him in something else. But yeah, I think that transformation is really strong, and he's almost unrecognizable. And it's not just in the costume, but like kind of the way he moves and like the way he stands and sits. It just feels like a different person, even mm-hmm. though it's, you know, vaguely the same face. So I thought that was a good performance. And just it's believable that he's kind of early on in the film, that he's kind of charismatic enough to charm his way up the social ladder a little bit, even though everyone, you know, immediately is pointing out to him that, you know, you don't belong here. Your clothes, you look like you're poor because of your clothes and all these things. So he kind of played the being a little bit of a ruffian well, at the same time mm-hmm. being charming. And it was believable that he was really curious and wanted to learn all these things too. So yeah, I agree. I think he was really strong. I thought that the one who played Elena was really good too. Her name's Jessica Cressy. She's not in much else, but a few other things. But if I have any criticism of the maybe the writing, it's just how it's like it's very much a love at first sight kind of thing when they first meet. And I guess that works actually, because when it ends up kind of falling apart, then you can see how it wasn't based on much other than kind of attraction maybe at the beginning. But when they first meet, she's so taken, like when he has, like when he leaves the house and she like lets her breath out, and she's so kind of bothered by his presence in a way that I thought was funny, but maybe not entirely believable. But I think she did a good job performing it. Anyway, I thought that was good. And then just in general, there's a lot of kind of old Italian man faces that are mm-hmm. that kind of make up the scenery around, and as he's at these parties and things, and it felt I like the vibe of it, I guess, with all the kind of supporting players. But yeah, I thought all the performances were pretty strong,
and I like the sort of older mentor, Brissenden guy or whatever his name was, that you know I appreciated him, and that he was you know that there was this sort of God, I almost wanted to see more of him because mm-hmm. I wanted to understand that relationship more, but you know, just that there was that he also seemed to be a guy that sort of worked his way up from, you know, the class levels. And in some ways it's like the relationship between Martin Eden and Elena seemed to almost be, in retrospect, I was sort of like, well, it seemed like he wanted to be in this house more than he wanted to be with her. Yeah. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? That he wanted that there was an ambition there that was, I don't know, you know, but and I'm not sure exactly how I was supposed to feel about that, but that's what I sort of took away.
She almost represents this life that he wishes he could have. And yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Good. Was there anything else that we haven't covered yet that you wanted to bring up about this movie?
I don't I don't think so. I mean, I'm interested in. I purposefully didn't read any, you know, reviews or or anything like that before. And I want to now that we've spoken. I just didn't want it to color anything,
for sure,
you know. But I'm interested to learn a little bit more about it, and if I can get any insight, you know, maybe interviews with the director and some of the. I'm in some ways I'm just most interested to find out, like, okay, well, why this piece? Why now?
Yeah.
And just, you know, and in terms of, you know, why this sort of American novel that I guess is pretty well known among his work, but isn't, like, you know, it wasn't something that I was like, oh, you're, you know, it's not a Catcher in the Rye. It's not something that everybody has heard of. So,
right.
You know, I was I'm interested to learn more about it in that way.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I'm trying to remember where I even first heard of it. I think on a podcast or something, somebody mentioned that it was getting a lot of praise. I think it played at Venice or something, maybe back in 2019. I think it's like IMDb lists this as a 2019 film, even though I think it's just now widely available in 2021, which is interesting. But there's not a lot of, you know, yeah, I try to do research about a movie without reading reviews, but there's really not a ton out there. But if you come across something, please share it with me and I'll share it out too. But, I enjoyed it. So I guess we can kind of wrap up, but I thought this was a good movie. I'm glad I watched it, and I'm glad to, I mean, if nothing else, I needed some more foreign films this season on my, my podcast. So glad we brought this in for that reason too. But yeah, I will recommend this right now. It is streaming on Mubi, which, is a streaming platform that I recommend as well, but I think it'll probably be on there for a while. I don't think it's one of the rotating selections. I think it's kind of in the permanent library, at least for a little bit, but it's also rentable online if anyone wants to check it out. But thank you so much, Graham, for being here. It's been I think a great discussion about this movie, and thanks for selecting this movie, and I'm just so happy to have had you on.
No, absolutely, thank you for introducing me to it. I'm glad we got to talk, and, you know, honored to be on here.
Of course, I hope to have you back before too long, because I think
absolutely
it's been great.
Let's do it.
Thanks again so much to Graham Gordy for being here. I loved talking movies with him, and I do hope he'll come back. Just before the episode wraps up, I'll say keep an eye out for the next few episodes. I'm going to have Rance Collins back on the show for an Oscar special after that ceremony in a few weeks. And before that, I've got friend of the show Andrew Camarillo back to discuss the film Minari. I'm also planning to do an episode on what is my favorite Oscar-nominated film, Sound of Metal. Stay tuned for that, and thank you so much for listening to Arthouse Garage. We've got a few years' worth of episodes now, and you can hear all of those in your podcast app of choice. Our theme music is by composer Paul Hunefeld. Learn more at appallingproductions.com. You'll find a link in the show notes. If you want to support Arthouse Garage, leave a rating or review in your podcast app, or you can buy an Arthouse Garage t-shirt at arthousegarage.com/shop. Stay in the loop about Arthouse Garage and the films we're covering by subscribing to our email newsletter. That's at arthousegarage.com/subscribe, or you can email me directly, andrew@arthousegarage.com. And of course, follow on social media. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd. Just search Arthouse Garage in all those places. You can find links in the show notes as well. And that will do it for this episode. Thank you again so much for listening, and until next time, keep it snob-free.